Right. I'm on. Fantastic. All right. So yeah. So I'd like to thank the speaker, thank the organizers for the chance to speak, and I'd like to thank all the speakers whose talks I have been enjoying. And off we go. So I'm going to be talking about things that involve some computational things and some combinatorial things and some computer algebra things, but they won't necessarily all happen at the same time. So I'm going to start off with a bit of toric varieties background, and the perspective I'm going to be taking is not starting with a polytope, though eventually the polytopes will come back. Then I'm going to say a little bit about intersection theory. And then I'm going to eventually, well, and intersection theory on toric varieties in particular. And depending on how much time I have, I'll probably wind up saying a bit about counting lattice points in polytopes. And So that's roughly what I'm going to be on about. So the way I'm going to be doing toric varieties is using fans, and so I'm going to explain what that is. If you're very much into polytopes, then and so you're thinking of a polytope already, then the fan that I'm going to be talking about is the outer normal fan of the polytope, but you probably knew that if you were so determined to do polytopes in the first place. So if you've not, then we're just going to launch into fans. So if I have a bunch of vectors, v1 to vr in q to the n, and I take just the positive linear combinations of them, then that is a convex rational polyhedral cone, and if C contains no full line, so no line heading off in both directions, it's strongly convex. And so a collection of strongly convex rational polyhedral cones is a fan if for all, okay, my collection is going to be called capital sigma, for all sigma and sigma, any face of sigma, so you can imagine these things are cones, but and they're finite sorts of beasts, so they have they're cut out by codimension one faces, and then they have smaller faces, etc. So I want any face of sigma is also in sigma, and I write faces of sigma as tau less than sigma, so any face tau of sigma, which I'm just going to write by a less than sign. And so tau less than sigma implies tau is in capital sigma. And for all sigma and tau in sigma, the intersection of sigma and tau is in capital sigma, is in my fan. So it's perfectly allowed for the intersection of sigma and tau to be just the origin. That is one of the cones in my fan. I remembered the thing that I was trying to think of when I was pausing over here, which is that when we eventually get to stuff that is my work, that is actually a lot of it joint with Jamie Palmersheim. So once we have a fan, we get a toric variety. So given sigma, we get a toric variety x sub sigma. And so to do this, we pick a ground field, but we're going to use the complex numbers, it won't really matter, but we may as well let it be the complex numbers. And since we started in n dimension, in Qn, this is going to be an n-dimensional variety. And how is it going to work? Well, there is going to be a torus, C star to the n, acting on x, and there's going to be one orbit for each sigma in sigma. So each of the cones gives you an orbit. The orbit I'm going to call O sigma. And there's a dimension reversal thing that happens. If the dimension of sigma is R, and by dimension of sigma, I really mean the dimension of the linear span of sigma. If the dimension of sigma is R, then the dimension of O sigma is going to be N minus R. And another thing that's very important for us to think about is V of sigma, which is by definition the closure of O sigma. And this is going to turn out to be just sort of a disjoint union of a bunch of orbits. So it's going to be the orbit O sigma, and then the closure of the orbit, and that closure is going to mean that we throw in a bunch of other orbits, and they're going to be precisely the taus that are bigger than sigma. So there is greater than or equal to O tau. So there's, like I said, there's sort of a dimension reversal thing that's going on here. So in particular, the origin itself, zero dimensional, corresponds to something, to an n-dimensional orbit, which is actually just a copy of the torus living inside there. And then everything else is smaller dimensional than that. So there's a big open torus, which in the fan picture is corresponding to the origin. And then there are little extra bits which have been added on. Well, that's one way of thinking of it, which correspond to the, so that the rays correspond to codimension one extra pieces, and then the bigger cones correspond to smaller pieces. So these are the closed torus invariant subvarieties of X sigma. Okay, so let's have a couple of examples. What sort of thing I'm talking about. So these examples are going to be very well-known varieties, but so it's just useful to see how they look like from this fan point of view. So example one is affine space. Affine space, just C to the n, has a torus sitting inside it, the C star to the n, sits inside C to the n, and C star to the n does act on C to the n, and it does act with a finite number of orbits. And so actually, just by sort of thinking about what those orbits really are, what makes something an orbit is, you know, choosing where the zeros are, choosing the zero coordinates. So that really tells you what the structure is of the orbits. It really tells you that it's a Boolean lattice. And so just from that, you can sort of tell what the you can take a good guess as to what the fan should be. The fan sigma is the let me write it the way I've written it down here. So the rays are just given by the positive coordinate vectors, E1 to EN, and then for I, any subset of 1 to N, we have sigma I is just the cone generated by the row I's, I and I. And that is giving you the obvious thing. So throwing everybody in here gives us the point 0,0,0,0,0, and the empty set here gives us the torus, which is corresponding to the cone 0. So and in two dimensions, we're just looking at this. So we have two one-dimensional grades, a two-dimensional cone here, and the origin. Example 2, projective space. Row I is, again, EI for 1 less than or equal to I less than or equal to n. But we also have row 0, which is negative the sum of the other row I's. And again, for I, a proper subset of 0 to n, we define sigma I to be generated. Oh, sorry, I guess I this is just a vector, and now when I multiply by q plus, I get an array. And then sigma I is generated by the appropriate row I's again. And so if you think about this, this is once again giving us projective space in a kind of unsurprising way. Again, you can see that inside a projective space there's a torus. One way of thinking about the fact that this is proper containment is that we've thrown away the irrelevant ideal. I don't know. Maybe that's not a helpful thing to say. So the picture is, of course, so here's the two-dimensional picture. We have three rays, three two-dimensional cones, and the origin. So the three cones correspond to the three points, the three torus invariant points, which you can see what they are. Okay. So these examples were non-singular, projective space, affine space, but that's not necessarily true for toric variety. So X sigma is non-singular if and only if for all cones sigma and sigma, sigma is simplicial. In other words, it's generated by the number of rays that it ought to be given its dimension. So that's automatically true in two dimensions. It's going to be generated by two rays. But in three dimensions, we'd like it to be generated by three rays and look like a cone over a triangle and not be generated by, say, four rays and look like a cone over a square or something. Sigma should be simplicial. And the lattice points on the rays, on the extreme rays of sigma, should generate z to d intersect the linear span of sigma. So that's not necessarily going to happen. They might generate a sublattice, and that is sort of and the degree of that sublattice in there is sort of a measure of how far you are from being simplicial. Something that is going to come up later, but I'm going to mention it now, is if you have an arbitrary fan that is, say, not smooth, so it's clear that, so for the first reason that there might be problems, right, you might have, things that are not simplices, so these non-simplicial cones, it's pretty easy to convince yourself that if you see such a thing, you could imagine a way to subdivide the fan to make it simplicial. I mean, you have to think about how to say that precisely, because life is not always as three-dimensional as we like to think. But you can do that. And in fact, more, you can subdivide further to make the cones actually be smooth. So what that's saying is, given any fan, there's a way to make this. There's not a canonical choice in general, though in some special cases there is. But in general, there's not a canonical choice, but you can do some kind of a dividing it up process to make it smooth. And the thing that turns out to happen on the level of the algebraic geometry is, if sigma prime subdivides sigma, if sigma prime subdivides sigma, then there's a map from x sigma prime to x sigma, which is birational and proper. And so in particular, if you choose sigma prime so that it is smooth, then this is what's called a resolution of singularities. So it's a way of taking your thing that was not so smooth and finding a smooth thing that sits over it. And that will turn out to be important later. One other piece of business, which I'm not sure how, I don't think I'm going to really refer to in detail, but let me just mention it. There is an open cover of X sigma by U sigma in the maximal cones of capital sigma. So these are different from the V sigmas and different from the O sigmas. These are yet another thing associated to, and in fact associated to any cone, but if you just want an open cover, you only have to take the maximal cones. So they give you an open cover. And that's going to be relevant when we talk about divisors on X sigma. So, that's the introduction to toric varieties from the fan point of view. Okay, so now on to intersection theory. So, suppose I have a divisor D. Let's be very general, and I just have some variety X, variety and D, a divisor given by local equations. F A on U A, where A is in some index set. I have a divisor on a variety, and let me just define Z I of X to be mainly, so far for bookkeeping purposes, the direct sum, just the free abelian group on V, the closed subvarieties of dimension I. I want to Z here. So this is just some humongous free abelian group. And now one thing that you can do with your divisor is you can say, my divisor actually defines a class that lives inside of Z. I don't want a double bar. I just want Z n minus 1 of X by saying D is defined to be the sum of the class of V times the order of vanishing of F at V. So I'm being sort of vague here, because actually I didn't have a single F. I had a whole bunch of Fs. I had a whole collection of local equations, right? But the point is that these local equations are not just a whole bunch of random things. They're all, they're all living in the function field on the variety, but also they're all, they have to have some compatibility so that this actually makes sense And the nice thing is that there's only going to be finitely many of these for which this is non-zero. So these are things where f has a zero or it has a pole. And so you get some collection of codimension one subvarieties with some coefficients expressing the multiplicities associated to a Cartier divisor. I guess I should really be calling this a Cartier divisor. Okay, so now what one? I'm going to express a kind of thing that one would like to do. Thing that one wants to do from the point of view of intersection theory, and then I'm going to explain the sort of normal intersection theory approach to doing it, and then eventually I'm going to explain a different way of doing it that you can sort of only do for toric varieties. So what you'd like to be able to do is you have this divisor, so on X, and what you'd like to be able to do is you'd like to be able to say W is an I-dimensional closed subvariety of X. What you'd like to be able to do is you'd like to be able to define an intersection of D with W, which I'm just going to denote by a dot. So you'd like to intersect this divisor class with W. And you'd like to get out of that a nice, well-defined thing that would be in Zi minus 1, some sum of codimension 1 subvarieties. So this is the idea of what it would feel like to be able to do intersection theory, or this is sort of what one would like, right? Part of the point is you can't really hope to say I have one subvariety, I have another subvariety, just thinking of them as subvarieties and be able to intersect them and be able to really understand what that means. You have to think that one of them is given by some equations that are being cut out. I'm sorry, I'm not explaining this very well. I don't think I'm going to try to say that. So we sort of want to be able to do that. And the natural candidate for this would be take your divisor D, restrict it to W, and now you have a divisor on W, and as we just saw, associated to a divisor is some codimension one thing, some of codimension one subvarieties there. So we could do this and be in Zi minus 1 of W inside of Zi minus 1 of X and be very pleased with ourselves. Unfortunately, this isn't going to work. The reason it's not going to work is that if we were unlucky, then W might be contained in the region, it might be contained in the codimension 1 stuff where D is 0, or in the codimension 1 stuff where D has a pole. So that would be bad, because then, you know, if we restricted to it, we aren't getting any information out. So this is sort of, this doesn't work. Right. So, this is why one develops intersection theory.
Sorry, you're saying if you try to intersect two subvarieties, where one is contained in the other, we have a problem?
Yes. That's exactly what I'm saying. Because we feel that the intersection should be, you know, codimension should be adding, but if we were just naively trying to intersect, then that wouldn't work. So we have to do something else. So what is the standard thing to do is the following thing. We pass to the Chow groups. So instead of taking these Zi's, we take the Chow group. So the Chow group, the ith Chow group of X is Zi of X modulo the principal divisors. So these are divisors that are generated by just one single local equation over the whole variety. Principal divisors on all the I plus one dimensional closed subvarieties. So we've sort of lost a bunch of information, so that instead of having actual cycles, we have cycles up to rational equivalence, which means we're allowing our cycles to wander off and be replaced by cycles that they're equivalent to up to a principal divisor on some dimension one bigger subvariety. The point of doing this is that now multiplication by D is well defined. It's well defined on AI of X. It is a map. It takes AI of X to AI minus 1 of X, multiplying by D. Okay, that now makes sense. The way it works is, if I have somebody in here, I can find a cycle that represents him, and I want to intersect him with D. And before we had this problem, that we didn't really know what would happen if D was sort of in bad position with respect to this cycle. But now what we can do is we can just allow D to move a bit and then move by a principal divisor, and then it won't be in bad position anymore, and so then we can intersect, and then what we get won't depend on how we did that flexing around, because well, it would depend on the cycle, but it doesn't depend modulo rational equivalence. So this is now well defined. So these are the Chow groups. And in fact, if you are non-singular, then the n minus first Chow group, the elements of the n minus first Chow group, can be viewed as divisors, and so. Or there's an isomorphism. So there's actually a ring structure which gives you an intersection product, so that all the A's, all the Chow groups taken together, form a ring if X is non-singular, where the unit is X, is the class of X itself in a n of x, and I'm sort of mentioning this to clarify that the grading that's happening here is not the usual grading, and we're generated in a n minus 1. I think we're generated in an n minus 1 of x. So the multiplication is kind of grading the opposite way, and so often people actually, you know, just sort of formally move the numbers upstairs and make them go backwards so that it looks more like the rich factor. And so this is a kind of algebraic geometers version of cohomology. And if life is sufficiently good, it's the same thing. In the context that we're interested in, it's going to be the same thing. So that is just a quick dash through a little bit of intersection theory. So I want to say a bit about intersection theory on toric varieties, which I realize is my title, but I'm not going to say as much about it as about the sort of more general story as I initially thought when I was writing my title. Anyway, references here are mostly Fulton's book for all the toric variety stuff, and then for intersection theory on toric varieties, there's a paper by Fulton and Sturmfels, which actually says a lot more than I'm going to possibly say, and there's references in there, and most of what I'm saying is actually from references and not actually from that paper itself. Anyway, so where am I going with this? Well, where I'm going are four toric varieties. There are some things that make the story a lot nicer. In general, these Chow groups are huge and hard to handle, hard to figure out, hard to say much about them. Or anyway, yeah. So, for toric varieties, life is much better because AI of X is generated, so you remember, this is generated by all the, so a priori, it's generated by all the dimension I closed subvarieties, right? That's a lot. It's actually generated by the torus invariant. That's what this T is going to mean here. These are the torus invariant subvarieties of dimension I. So there's only finitely many of these. So that says that in particular, these are finite abelian groups, not just some humongous infinite things. So much easier to handle. Secondly, we actually also know what the relations are. The relations come from the, again, it's sort of the best thing you could hope for. They're generated by the torus invariant stuff, and again, the relations also come from torus invariant stuff. The relations come from principal torus equivariant divisors on, so relations in AI of X come from principal torus equivariant divisors on torus invariant subvarieties of dimension I plus 1. So it's exactly the same story, but we only have to worry about torus invariant stuff. So again, there's finitely many relations as well. I mean, there's finitely many relations, and it's possible to be really explicit about what they are. Let me just say what's happening in dimension n minus 1. So in dimension n minus 1, we have a n minus 1. So this is the abelian group on the rays, the dimension 1 rays, which correspond to codimension 1 subvarieties. So this is just the maybe that's kind of crappy notation. Sorry, let me write that, and then maybe it's clearer that I just mean a copy of Z for each of the rays, modded out by something really explicit, which is U comma VI row I, where VI is the first lattice point along the ray row I, and this is really a duality pairing, but we can just think about this as being somebody else in ZD, so this is for any U in ZD. So we kill these things off, these linear combinations. Okay, sorry, there's a sum over I there. So for any U in ZD, but obviously it suffices to consider a basis, so it gives you the nice finite set of relations. And so these U's really are locally, this U is really the local equation of a principal divisor on the whole variety, which is what's going on in dimension one bigger. So now one could say more about each of the child groups, and what these relations look like, and there's a nice connection to Dane-Somerville equations, but I'm not going to talk about that. What I'm going to talk about is the Chow group, or the Chow ring. So if we just consider all the groups together, as I said, this forms a ring, and this has a really nice description. So this is polynomial ring in a bunch of variables, which I'm going to call rho I as well. So this is now a polynomial ring. I'm sorry about the confusion between this, which is an abelian group, and this, which is a polynomial ring. Is it clear what I'm doing? Okay. Well, hopefully I've set it anyway, even if it wasn't clear. So, yes, so polynomial ring, modulo, what do we kill? Well, obviously we kill the stuff that's already died in dimension one has to die, right? In codimension one, this stuff here that's dying in codimension one has to die in. We have to kill it, so we kill that stuff. And then, what else is the most obvious thing that we could possibly say disappears here? Well, remember, so these rays are codimension one subvarieties. And this product is really about intersection. So if I have two rays that don't intersect, if I have two rays whose corresponding codimension one subvarieties don't intersect, then their product has to disappear. How do we see that in the fan? That happens in the fan precisely if those rays don't have any cone that contains both of them. So what we are killing here is exactly the Stanley-Reisner ideal of the fan. So this is sort of, for the stupidest reason possible, these things have to be zero. There isn't any, geometrically, there isn't any intersection at all of those things. There isn't anywhere for them to intersect. So their product has to be zero. And then we have this stuff, and that's it. That fully describes this. So this is a bunch of monomials. This is a bunch of terms in degree one. Well, I mean, the grading screwed up, but you know what I mean. These are linear terms, and then we have a bunch of Stanley-Reisner monomials. And that's the intersection ring. And if sigma is only simplicial, then, so simplicial but not as nice as being singular, this works. But we have to be rational instead of being integral. What? I didn't think I needed that. No, I don't think I need that. I mean, I seem to get the right answer, at least for affine space. Killing these linear guys would make this stuff all die. Just to take one completely trivial example. So I think maybe that's not necessary, but maybe it is. Let me now return to the question that I said was sort of motivating us and propose a different sort of way to base intersection theory. It makes it sound as though I think that, you know, I'm not pretending that this thing that I'm about to develop is of anything like equal importance. But we take a different direction from the same initial question, which was, we want. Yes, here we are. This initial question. So we have a divisor, we have W, and we want to intersect them and get a cycle out. Only now, because we're being toric, let's restrict ourselves and consider that we're only going to deal with toric things. So these are torus equivariant Cartesian divisors and their torus invariant subvarieties. And so we'd like something out that's again torus invariant. And how are we going to do it? Well, what do we really want? Let me write down the properties that we would really like. We would really like a map that takes the torus invariant cycles. So for any toric divisor D, we want a map that takes the i-dimensional subvarieties to i minus one linear combinations of i minus one dimensional subvarieties. We would like that this multiplication should be de-restricted, the class of de-restricted W, if this is well-defined. I mean, as I said, this won't necessarily be well-defined. And if it's not well-defined, obviously, we can't really hope for that. But if it's well-defined, we want that. We want that if we pass two rational equivalents, so if we imagine, if we think of what's happening in modulo rational equivalents in the Chow groups, we would like our action to agree with that action. So if we pass from the subvariety in Z to A and we hit that with D in the Chow group, we'd like to get the same thing if we hit D, hit the thing with D, and then we pass the Chow group. And finally, we would like commutativity and so this is sort of a wish list. It's not clear that, I mean, a priori, really, there's no reason that there should be such a thing. But it turns out that there is. So this is cycle level intersection theory. As I said, there's no reason for it to exist. And since there's no reason for it to exist, we shouldn't really expect at all that it would be possible to come up with such a thing without any, without making any choices, right? Because somehow it's not a natural thing to be able to do, to intersect cycles and get cycles out. So some choice has to be made. But what is that choice? It's not that bad a choice. For each sigma in sigma, choose psi, choose psi of sigma, a linear subspace complementary to the linear span of sigma in Q to the n. And such that there's some agreement condition that if sigma is a phase of tau, then psi of tau, the subspace corresponding to tau, should be contained in the subspace corresponding to sigma. And then once we fix a choice of psi, I claim that there is a well-defined cycle-level intersection theory. Now this might seem like kind of a crazy thing. I'm asking you to go around fixing a cone for each sigma and blah blah blah. It seems, you know. Yes.
Can you rethink what you mean by cycle intersection
theory? Oh, okay. So given what I want is for D a toric Cartier divisor. I want an intersection product that takes Cartier divisors cross Z I T of X to Z I minus 1 T of X. So given a divisor and a cycle of dimension I want to get out a cycle of dimension I minus 1, which is somehow looks like intersection, looks like naive intersection, when naive intersection makes sense, looks like the fancier Chow group version of doing intersection, always, and is commutative. It's not on the cycle level. It's a quotient of cycles. So you're not getting out actual cycles. The Chow ring, you have cycles modulo rational equivalence. So that's the point. It's a question of doing things actually on the cycle, on getting cycles out versus getting out cycles modulo rational equivalence. And you might ask why one would care a lot about that. And hopefully I will get to the bit where I say that. Yeah, okay. I will try very hard to get to that bit and avoid some of the other bits here. Let me just say how you might choose such a thing in such a way that it doesn't seem like a great deal of trouble to go to define such a thing, and there are two obvious ways of doing it. One of them is put an inner product on Z to B, and let psi of sigma just be the orthogonal complement to the linear span of sigma for any sigma. Or choose a generic flag zero less than F1, da, 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 less than F, and a generic complete flag, and set psi of sigma. To each sigma, we want to associate a linear subspace. What we're going to do is we're just going to say psi of sigma is going to be Fi, where I is n minus the dimension of the linear span of sigma, just regardless of sigma. We're not even going to care about which sigma it is. We're just going to assign all the sigmas of a given dimension to the same linear subspace in the flag. That works fine, except we can't define this for any cone because there's this genericity condition, because the linear subspace that we choose has to be complementary to the linear span of sigma. So you can't use the second approach to get something that works all the time.
Once you make this choice, there's a unique way to define the intersection product, and basically the point is that now this gives you sort of a smart direction to shift D in. If you need to shift D because D intersects the cycle you're trying to intersect with badly, then you need to shift D. As I was saying before, when we're doing Chow groups, you just shift it whatever way you like. It doesn't matter. Here we want to shift it in one specific way, but that's kind of given to us because of the way that Z of D gets decomposed into the span of sigma and psi of sigma. So once you do this, then you can define a ring structure on the level of cycles. So instead of having the Chow ring on cycles modular rational equivalence, you get an actual ring structure on the level of cycles, which again has a nice it has a nice presentation in the inner product case. It has a somewhat less nice presentation in the generic flag case. I think I'm going to skip that because I want to get to what is, in some sense, the point, the application that we have for this, which, unfortunately, I won't really get to. People saw that happening. The point is, if you have a nice formula, let me give you an example of a formula. The Todd class of X, if X is non-singular, the Todd class of X is product from I equals 1 to R, so product over all the rays of DI. DI is just the divisor corresponding to ray row I. DI divided by 1 minus e to the negative di, where we think of this actually as a power series in di. Like to make sense of this, you think of this as a formal power series in di, and then you multiply them all together, but the terms past the nth aren't going to matter because there's nothing there. So we don't have to worry about convergence or anything. So we have this product. So when you expand this out, you get a bunch of, you get something quite explicit, just 1 plus d, so it's a product of 1 plus di over 2 plus di squared over 12 plus blah, blah, blah. Right? So you get something like this. When you multiply that out in the Chow group, you get the Todd class. Well, if you just multiply that out in the cycle level thing, then you get a cycle level Todd class. So you get a specific cycle which represents the Todd class. Um,
So multiplying this out in there, instead of in Chow group, in the Chow ring, you get a cycle which represents side class. Now, the interesting thing is, so you get something like Todd class of X equals sum over all the rays in sigma of the class of sigma times something. Right? And the reason that I wrote that something as mu of sigma is that if you work it out, that mu of sigma doesn't actually depend on the global structure of the fan. It only depends on sigma. Obviously, it depends on sigma. It also depends on your original choice of psi and stuff like that. But if you chose, for instance, the inner product psi, so you have psi fixed and everything, then you're getting out associated to any cone. You have this mu. It's well-defined. It doesn't depend on the flag as a whole. So sort of understanding the Todd class of any toric variety is in some sense reduced to understanding what this mu is. That answers a question of Danilov. He asked, was there some uniform, consistent way to assign values to cones that would have this property? And so the answer is yes. And this is one way to do it. There's a particular reason to care about having an expression for the Todd class like this, which has to do with the fact that the Todd class shows up in Riemann-Roch and gets used in particular, and that is then related to counting lattice points, because lattice points in a polytope correspond to global sections. So this having such formula for the Todd class gives you a formula, which I may as well just... Okay, I'm just going to write down something that won't necessarily mean a lot. So if P is a polytope, the number of lattice points in P is sum over faces of the volume of the face times mu of the corresponding outer normal cone. So you basically, if you have a mu like this, then you throw this through the Riemann-Roch machinery and you wind up with a formula for the number of lattice points in a polytope as a combination of the volumes of the faces. So you get the big face. So the leading term here is the volume of the polytope itself, which is a reasonable approximation to the number of lattice points. But then there's correction terms. So I think that's really all I have time to say. So in that anticlimactic and generally unwinding fashion.